The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated October 10/October 17, 2022. It's back to its bright red border. There's no white inner border because the background of the cover is white. Time, in its usual large block letterings in all caps, is in gray, superimposed upon that white. And there's a portrait of a military person, not a U.S. military person, behind the person's shoulder and headshot is an abstract watercolor, perhaps, of the Ukrainian flag with blue on top and yellow on the bottom. The caption reads, "The General, Valery Zelushny, and the Ukrainian Way of War," and that photograph or illustration is attributed to Oleksiy Chumachenko. It looks like a photographic portrait to me with that abstract watercolor background of the flag. This person is looking askance from the camera with what look like blue-gray eyes. His face holds a stern expression. He's neither smiling nor grimacing, but the line between his lips is rather level and flat. He has all types of insignia, which is unknown to me, in that uniform. It looks like a dark khaki gray, but I'm not sure because we have that blue and yellow flag over and around it. He has a white shirt and a tie that matches the coloration of his cap and jacket. The first reading here is for the record, and it is 7 short items, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. "You have utterly failed," said Senator Ron Johnson at a September 20 Senate hearing over findings that the Justice Department undercounted nearly 1,000 deaths in jails and prisons last year. $200 is the daily fee of the Himalayan Kingdom of Bhutan began charging all tourists when it reopened its borders September 23. 5% additional water in the Earth's atmosphere after a volcanic eruption near Tonga in January, according to a September 22 study in Science. Researchers say the added vapor could cause further global warming. "If he is the nominee, I won't be a Republican," stated Representative Liz Cheney, referring to former President Donald Trump, to the Texas Tribune, September 24. "It's a disgrace that a week after this storm, we still don't fully have water," said Hevel Velez Luciano, who was among more than 1 million Puerto Ricans left without utilities after Hurricane Fiona hit the island September 18, said to NBC News. "Some people kind of hold it like a football with the wings out and then they shoot it." Kiana Sue Powers, an Iceland tourism influencer, to NPR about the Icelandic practice of collecting lost baby puffins. and throwing them off cliffs, which helps them find their way out to sea. I want people out there to know that there are citizens in Japan who are opposing this event, said Shinsaku Nohira, one of thousands of protesters at the September 27 state funeral of assassinated former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to CNN. Counter-Strike. This is beneath the caption, World, how Valeri Zaluzhny, Z-A-L-U-Z-H-N-Y, Zaluzhny, and the Ukrainian military turned the tide of war, by Simon Schuster and Vera Bergengruen. There's a photo here. It's a double spread photo, two pages, side by side. Green in the background. Well, actually, in the background, it's slate gray. Just in front of that, lots of green, a forest of trees. Winding its way through this forest of trees, and at an intersection, sloshy, muddy roads, absolutely slippery looking and sloppy looking. There's a tank coming toward the camera person. It flies the Ukrainian flag of blue and yellow. There are solar panels at that intersection. There's a bridge further up the road. I think it is intact. And then there's an abandoned vehicle with all kinds of markings on it. A small vehicle, like, just a compact car. But it's also in the coloration of the tank. It's that dark khaki green-brown. Again, Valeri Zaluzhny, Zaluzhny, and the Ukrainian military. The caption reads, for this double-page photo, a Ukrainian tank passes a former Russian checkpoint September 26 in the retaken city of Izyum, I-Z-Y-U-M, and the photograph was by Evgeny Maloletka. And I apologize if I've mispronounced any of those Ukrainian names. It would be easy to underestimate Valeri Zaluzhny. When not in uniform, the general prefers T-shirts and shorts that match his easygoing sense of humor. When he first heard from aides to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in late July 2021 that he was being tapped to lead the country's armed forces, his stunned response was, "What do you mean?" As it sank in that he would become commander-in-chief, he tells Time in his first interview since the Russian invasion began, he felt as if he had been punched, not just below the belt, but straight into a knockout. George Patton, or Douglas MacArthur, he is not. Yet when the history of the war in Ukraine is written, Zaluzhny is likely to occupy a prominent role. He was part of the Ukrainian brass who spent years transforming the country's military from a clunky Soviet model into a modern fighting force. Hardened by years of battling Russia on the Eastern Front, he was among a new generation of Ukrainian leaders who learned to be flexible and delegate decisions to commanders on the ground. His dogged preparation in the run-up to the invasion and savvy battlefield tactics in the early phases of the war helped the nation fend off the Russian onslaught. Zaluzhny has emerged as the military mind his country needed, U.S. General Mark Milley wrote for Time of his counterpart last May. His leadership enabled the Ukrainian armed forces to adapt quickly with battlefield initiative against the Russians. That initiative has now taken a key turn in Ukraine's favor. In Kyiv's biggest gain since the war began in February, a lightning counteroffensive in the country's northeast in early September stunned Russian troops, who fled in disarray and ceded vast swaths of occupied territory. Combined with a second operation in the south, Ukrainian forces say they wrested back more than 6,000 square kilometers from Russian control in less than 2 weeks, liberating dozens of towns and cities and cutting off enemy supply lines. The Ukrainian army's deft game of misdirection, touting a counteroffensive in the south before attacking in the northeast, caught Russia off guard, and it validated the Ukrainians' arguments that intelligence collaboration and billions of dollars in weapons and materiel supplied by Western allies would yield results on the battlefield. The sudden victories came at a critical point in what had become a grinding war of attrition. As the economic pressures built across Europe and around the world, skeptics were beginning to doubt whether Ukraine could endure a protracted fight. The dramatic rout rattled Moscow, forcing Kremlin propagandists to admit the setback and upping the military and political pressures on Russian President Vladimir Putin. September 21, he responded by announcing the first mass conscription since World War II, a partial mobilization of up to 300,000 citizens. Ukrainian and U.S. officials alike believe the war will be longer and bloodier than most imagine. Putin has shown he's willing to sacrifice his troops and commit atrocities to exhaust his adversary. In a menacing speech, he warned he was not bluffing when he threatened to use everything at his disposal to defend Russia, an allusion to nuclear weapons. The recent Ukrainian offensive may be a turning point, but it's not the decisive blow. In hindsight, we will look at this like the Battle of Midway, says Dan Rice, a U.S. Army combat veteran and leadership executive at West Point, who serves as a special advisor to Zhilusny, referring to the pivotal 1942 clash that preceded 3 more years of war. Zhilusny is just one of many Ukrainians responsible for the grit and progress of the nation's outmanned army. Other key officers include General Oleksandr Sirsky, the commander of Ukraine's ground forces, who led the defense of Kyiv and more recently the counteroffensive in the east, and Kirilo Budanov, the head of Ukraine's military intelligence service. But after the president, Zhilusny has become the face of the war effort. His persona is omnipresent on Ukrainian social media. One widely shared image shows the Iron General kneeling in front of the sobbing mother of one of his soldiers, head bowed in grief in front of a casket. In another, he flashes a grin while presiding over the wedding of one of his servicemen during a lull in the fighting. Fan channels on Telegram have hundreds of thousands of followers, with many changing their profiles to a photo of the general, with his hands held in the shape of a heart. When Zhilusny walks into a dark room, he does not turn on the light. He turns off the darkness, one viral TikTok video jokes. It is hard to predict where the war's headed or the part Zhilusny will play in the end, but perhaps for the first time it now seems possible that the army he commands could achieve victory. Zhilusny was drinking a beer at his wife's birthday party when he stepped outside to take a cell phone call and learned about his new job. The 48-year-old general's rank and stature at the time were far below the position Zelensky was offering him. Commander-in-chief of the armed forces in Ukraine is the nation's top military title, outranked only by the president himself. The height of that perch induced a feeling like vertigo. I've often looked back and asked myself, how did I get myself into this? Zhilusny told Time in a June interview. To some, the choice seemed rash. While he'd earned a reputation as an aggressive and ambitious commander, Zhilusny also was considered a bit of a goofball, better known for clowning around with his troops than disciplining them. Born on a Soviet military garrison in northern Ukraine in 1973, he says he had dreams of becoming a comedian, much like Zelensky himself. Instead, he followed in the footsteps of his military family, entering the academy at Odessa in the 1990s as the Soviet Union collapsed and Ukraine descended into crisis. Stopping here to give you the caption of a photograph, it is Zhelezny with President Zelensky at a session of Parliament, July 28. Zelensky's wearing a dark green to khaki T-shirt and trousers. He's shaking hands with Zhelezny, who's in his camouflage gear. And he has a crew cut, no headgear. And Zelensky has almost a crew cut. He has a short, straight haircut with facial hair. Ukraine's reclaimed territory. There's a map here, an outline of Ukraine. Kiev, the capital, is in the north-central part, part of the country. And the occupied forces of Russia settled in at the northeast down to the Crimean Sea portion of Ukraine. Crimea, which is way at the south on the Black Sea, and Luhansk were in Russian control before February 24. Now, there are Ukrainian counteroffensives near Kharkiv, kind of a pointy area towards the northeast, and at, well, it's just a little thin, two little thin strips above Mariupol and Kherson, again, in the southeast, just north of Crimea. And then there's something between Kharkiv and Luhansk. That is where the Russian control was advancing at the time this map was drawn. On the edges of Ukraine, going clockwise from the lower left, Romania, Moldova, Poland, Belarus, Russia, and at the very south, the Black Sea. Returning now to the text. Zelensky rose through the ranks with a new generation of officers that bridged very different eras. Raised in Soviet Ukraine, but eager to shed USSR military dogma. For a master's thesis, Zelensky analyzed U.S. military structure. Seeing how Ukrainian forces were still weighed down by the Soviet model that relied on rigid, top-heavy decision-making, he began to implement changes to mirror the forces of U.S. and NATO partners. Zelensky worked his way from commanding a platoon to leading the country's forces on the Eastern Front, following Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014. In that role, he developed junior officers and encouraged more agile decision-making, pushing down authority to commanders on the ground. Unlike in the Russian army, sergeants would not be scapegoats, but rather real deputies meant to create a pipeline of military talent, he said in a 2020 interview published by the Ukrainian Defense Ministry. There's no going back, he said, to the army of 2013. But Zelensky also respected and admired the institutions of his Russian counterparts. In his office, he keeps the collected works of General Valery Gerasimov, the head of the Russian armed forces, who's 17 years his senior. I was raised on Russian military doctrine, and I still think that the science of war is all located in Russia, Zelensky says. I learned from Gerasimov. I read everything he wrote. He is the smartest of men, and my expectations of him were enormous. When Zelensky took office in 2019, the war in eastern Ukraine was already in its fifth year, and Zelensky was acting commander in the war zone. It fell to him to brief the new president on military operations and command structures. He knew Zelensky had never served in the military and had no plans to school him in the tactical details of warfare. He does not need to understand military affairs any more than he needs to know about medicine or bridge building, Zelensky says. To his surprise, Zelensky seemed to agree. This has turned out to be one of Zelensky's strongest features, says Oleksiy Melnyk, a former Ukrainian assistant defense minister. He's allowed his generals to run the show without direct interference into military business. In 2020, Zelensky oversaw an ambitious set of military exercises, which included a test of the Javelin anti-tank missile. With the president watching from the observation deck, the demonstration failed, and pundits went on Ukrainian TV to debate the bad omen for the nation's military. Zelensky was sure he would be known in the president's office as the loser with the faulty javelins. Yet Zelensky has shown a determination to jettison an older generation of officials in search of new blood and a habit of elevating leaders with whom he feels a rapport, regardless of rank. In July 2021, with the Russians hauling tanks to the border and the Americans warning Ukraine could soon face a full-scale attack, the president decided to put Zelensky in charge. "I gave my opinion that he strikes me as a fairly professional, smart person," says Andriy Yermak, Zelensky's chief of staff. "But the president made the call." Unlike Zelensky, who was skeptical of intelligence reports that a mass-scale Russian invasion was imminent, Zelensky was part of a corps of Ukrainian officers who viewed it as a matter of time. Within weeks of taking up his post, he began to implement key changes. Officers would be free to return fire with any available weapons if they came under attack, with no need for permission from senior commanders. "We needed to knock down their desire to attack," Zelensky says. "We also needed to show our teeth." By early February, the pressure of his new role was starting to show. The launch of an ambitious set of military exercises involving thousands of Ukrainian troops had been a disappointment, with basic maneuvers meant to simulate a Russian attack exposing cracks in Ukraine's defenses. In Zelensky's view, the drills were a centerpiece of Ukraine's defensive strategy, its best chance of survival, and the commanders were not taking them seriously. "I spent an hour yelling," he recalls. "I lost it." The men seated around the table were mostly older and more experienced than Zelensky, who did not have a reputation for losing his cool. "I explained to them that if they can't pull this off, the consequences will not only cost us our lives, but also our country." After the outburst, the generals picked up their preparations. They relocated and camouflaged military hardware, moving troops and weapons out of their bases and sending them on tours around the country. This included aircraft, tanks, and armored vehicles, as well as the anti-aircraft batteries Ukraine would soon need to maintain control of its skies. "There's no mistaking the smell of war," Zelensky says, and it was already in the air. But when it came to the details of his strategy, Zelensky held them close. "I was afraid that we would lose the element of surprise," he says. "We needed the adversary to think that we were all deployed in our usual bases, smoking grass, watching TV, and posting on Facebook." When the invasion started, the morning of February 24, the general had two strategic goals for Ukraine's defense. "We could not allow Kyiv to fall," he said, "and on all the other vectors we had to spill their blood, even if in some places it would require losing territory." The aim, in other words, was to allow the Russians to advance and then destroy their columns in the front and supply lines in the rear. By the sixth day of the invasion, he concluded it was working. The Russians had failed to take airports around Kiev and had advanced deep enough to begin straining supply lines, leaving them exposed. Milley, Zhelensky's U.S. counterpart, was in some ways astounded when he saw the Ukrainians holding out. He asked Zhelensky whether he planned to evacuate to safer ground. "I told him I don't understand you," Zhelensky says. "For me, the war started in 2014. I did not run away then, and I am not going to run now." He, too, was surprised by Russia's blunders. When the enemy faced heavy resistance or lost the ability to resupply, they did not retreat or shift to a different approach. They just herded their soldiers into the slaughter, Zhelensky said. "They chose the scenario that suited me best of all." Even as the U.S. and allies continued to flood the country with billions in military aid, the news was grim. Russia pounded the strategic port city of Mariupol, killing thousands of civilians. In May, hundreds of Ukrainian fighters who had defended the last stronghold in the city, the Azovstal steel plant, surrendered. More than 150 were returned September 21 in a prisoner swap, including five top Ukrainian commanders. Mass graves were discovered in towns and villages occupied by Russian troops. Still, Ukrainian officials insisted they could win. "We will fight until the last drop of blood," Zhelensky told Time. A few weeks later, Ukraine began to do something that struck military analysts as unusual. From the top of the government, Ukrainian officials, including Zelensky and Defense Minister Oleksiy Reznikov, began to publicly tout their preparations for a large-scale operation to retake territory in the south. In anticipation of an attack, Russia began to reposition troops, including some of its most elite units, from other regions to reinforce its positions in the south. August 29, the Ukrainian military announced that the long-anticipated southern offensive had begun. But there were indications something else was afoot. "We have a war on, not only in the south," Oleksiy Donilov, the head of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council, told Time September 1. "The front line is 2,500 kilometers long." Many experts doubted Ukraine would be capable of mounting a counteroffensive on one front, let alone two. 5 days later, Ukrainian troops launched a surprise strike in the country's northeast. The Russians were caught off guard. Many fled in disarray, leaving behind weapons and equipment. Local reports painted a humiliating picture of retreat, describing soldiers stealing civilians' clothes, bicycles, and cars to escape. In 6 days, the Ukrainian military retook an estimated 3,000 square kilometers of Russian-held territory, including strategically important rail hubs used to resupply its forces. The strike stunned the Kremlin, U.S. officials, and even top Ukrainians. "I taught myself to moderate my expectations so as not to be disappointed later," Reznikov tells Time. Some breakthroughs occurred a little faster than planned. Intelligence and advanced weaponry provided by the West also helped. "They gave us the location of the enemy, how many of them are at that location, and what they have stored there," Reznikov says. "Then we would strike." The High Mobility Artillery Rocket System, HIMARS, provided by the Pentagon, allowed Ukraine to destroy warehouses of ammunition, fuel, and command posts. Lighter vehicles like U.S.-donated Humvees, as well as trucks and tanks sent by the U.K., Australia, the Netherlands, Poland, and the Czech Republic, allowed them to outmaneuver the Russians. Ukrainians have demonstrated much better distributed tactical-level operations, says Jeffrey Edmonds, a former CIA analyst and Russia director on the National Security Council. "They're much more disciplined." Also crucial, Ukrainian officials say, was the flexible command structure that allowed them to exploit the quick Russian collapse. The Ukrainian army has the freedom to make decisions at every level, Reshnikov says, likening it to NATO standards. They do it quickly, unlike the Russians. Ukrainian officials are careful to spread the credit for the military successes so far. It is not the story of one star, but a constellation of our military elite, Reshnikov says, naming a long list of celebrated officers from the armed forces, the infantry, navy, air force, medical corps, and others. There are rumors of tensions between Zelensky and his top military commander, though the president and his aides have dismissed them. The so-called conflict with Zelensky was invented by our opposition from start to finish, says Oleksiy Arestovych, a Zelensky aide and veteran of Ukraine's military intelligence service. On the one hand, it's obviously made up. On the other, it has a painful effect, because stirring up conflict between the military commander and the commander-in-chief is a catastrophe. Hardened by war, Ukrainian leaders know the recent successes have only bought time. Russia has staked everything on this war, says Donilov, the head of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council. Putin cannot lose. The stakes are too high. Ukraine's operations in the south have moved slowly. As winter approaches, Kyiv must take care not to overextend its forces. And there are forces at play outside Ukraine's control. The looming energy crisis could sap Western military support, with Russia already cutting its share of gas supplies to Europe from 40% to 9%. For his part, Zelensky's girding for a long and bloody slog. Knowing what I know firsthand about the Russians, our victory will not be final, he told Time. Our victory will be an opportunity to take a breath and prepare for the next war. That was Counter-Strike, written by Simon Schuster and Vera Bergengruen, with reporting by Leslie Dickstein and Simone Shaw. From the brief, Deny, Distract, Delay, by Brian Bennett. Trump's growing legal woes are stress-testing the limits of a legal strategy honed over decades. There's a photo here. It's almost all in black, with a few spotlights facing the camera. And standing in it is the profile, I'm sure, of former President Donald Trump. Nearly 50 years ago, Donald Trump learned the legal strategy that would repeatedly get him out of tight legal jams. Here's a photo, in fact, in black and white, of a much younger former President Trump, seated next to his legal attorney, Roy Cohn. They're both dressed in suits, light shirts, and ties. They're both seated in front of microphones, although Mr. Trump is speaking into the microphones. The caption reads, Donald Trump learned his combative legal strategies from his longtime attorney, Roy Cohn, C-O-H-N. It was 1973, and the Justice Department had just filed a civil rights lawsuit against Trump and his father, Fred Trump. The complaint alleged the Trumps and their company, which managed some 14,000 apartments in Queens, Brooklyn, and Staten Island, had violated the Fair Housing Act by systematically flagging the applications of black renters and steering them away from available units. To push back, the Trumps hired the famously combative Roy Cohn, Senator Joseph McCarthy's chief counsel during the 1950s Red Scare hearings, and sued the Justice Department for $100 million, claiming defamation. The case naming the Trumps was settled 2 years later. That early entanglement with the Justice Department drove home to Trump key lessons he's carried with him through five decades of lawsuits and tax challenges. Two impeachments and now more legal investigations than a former president has ever faced. September 21, New York Attorney General Letitia James compounded Trump's legal woes, announcing the state was suing Trump, three of his adult children, and the Trump Organization, and senior management in the company, alleging business fraud involving the value of assets. The sheer number of investigations and the increasingly tangled defenses his legal team is having to put on paper and argue in court amount to a stress test of Trump's standard strategy to deny, deflect, delay, and not put anything in writing. I don't think there's any other president who was in a similar legal jeopardy after leaving office, says Timothy Naftali, a historian at New York University and former director of the federal Richard Nixon Presidential Library and Museum. Warren Harding's administration was investigated by his own president, vice president, and successor, Calvin Coolidge. Nixon would have been the target of investigation for years if Gerald Ford had not pardoned him. Even Nixon pales by comparison, says Norman Eisen, an anti-corruption expert at Brookings Institution and the former special counsel to the Democrats' House Judiciary Committee during Trump's first impeachment. In Georgia, Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis is now looking into how Trump pressured election officials to swing the 2020 presidential election in his direction. The House January 6 committee and the Department of Justice are both examining what role Trump played in the lead-up to that deadly attack. Federal prosecutors have an active criminal investigation into Trump's hoarding of thousands of government documents. A New York State civil lawsuit announced by James in late September is on top of a separate criminal investigation into the Trump Organization by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office that is set to go to trial in October. In that case, as well as all those naming him, Trump has employed the tried and true playbook he first learned all those years ago from Cohn for staying out of prison and staying in business, according to Jennifer Taub, a professor of Western New England University School of Law, who has tracked the way Trump has evaded accountability for decades. Here's what he learned from Roy Cohn. Don't put things in writing. Punch back harder. Focus on optics. Who cares what the courts say, says Taub. Denial and deflection are often Trump's first instincts, no matter the facts on the ground. The day after FBI agents searched Mar-a-Lago and found dozens of documents with classified markings, Trump denied blocking multiple requests for him to return the records. The National Archives soon showed officials had had more than a year of exchanges with Trump's lawyers about returning those government documents. He then falsely compared his predicament with the conventional and orderly process by which former President Barack Obama worked with the National Archives to properly secure records for his presidential library. Trump initially appeared to score a recent win when a federal judge agreed to his request that a special master review the documents seized from Mar-a-Lago. But Trump's bid to delay the investigation may have backfired, as Raymond Deary, the judge brought in for that task, appears inclined to speed the investigation along. As Trump defends his decision to keep those documents at Mar-a-Lago, what he's written down and what he hasn't come with higher legal stakes. Trump has said repeatedly the papers at Mar-a-Lago were declassified, going so far as to falsely claim on Fox News that presidents can declassify documents by thinking about it. Suddenly, Trump's habit of avoiding putting things in writing could be a liability. Trump once berated his White House counsel, Don McGahn, for taking notes during an Oval Office meeting about Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. "Why do you take notes? Lawyers don't take notes. I never had a lawyer who took notes," Trump said. McGahn said he took notes because he was a real lawyer, and it created a record fuss. "I've had a lot of great lawyers like Roy Cohn," Trump said. He did not take notes. From the news ticker, six short items. Russia tries to annex parts of Ukraine. Following sham referendums organized by the Kremlin and held in occupied Ukraine, Russian administrations in four regions in southern and eastern Ukraine claimed residents had voted September 23 through September 27 to join Russia. Ukraine and its Western allies said the vote was illegal and would not be recognized. Cubans vote for marriage equality. Cuba approved an expansive family law September 26 that allows same-sex couples to marry and adopt children. About two-thirds of the population voted in favor of the measure, which faced fierce opposition from the country's growing evangelical movement and other conservative Cubans. British pound plunges to record low. The British pound plummeted to a record low of $1.03 on September 26, raising concerns about the stability of the nation's economy. The plunge followed an announcement the UK would impose the biggest tax cuts in 50 years in an effort to blunt the impact of inflation and rising energy prices. Student loan forgiveness challenged. A California libertarian group, the Pacific Legal Foundation, challenged President Biden's student debt forgiveness plan with a lawsuit September 27. The group argued that Biden does not have the authority to cancel up to $20,000 in federal student debt per borrower and asked a judge to halt the plan. Chess Champ accuses rival of cheating. World chess champion Magnus Carlsen accused a rival who won a surprise victory over him of cheating. In a September 26 statement, Carlsen alleged Hans Niemann cheated during in-person chess games. Niemann had admitted to cheating in online matches years ago, but has denied any wrongdoing during in-person matches. McConnell backs election law change. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell will proudly support legislation to overhaul the rules for certifying presidential elections in response to the January 6, 2021 riots, he said September 27. The change would close the loophole Donald Trump tried to use to stop President Biden from assuming office. From the Bulletin, NASA's asteroid collision could one day save the world. Near-Earth space is swarming with asteroids, nearly 30,000 of them, and the largest ones pose a risk to our planet, threatening us with a cosmic collision, like the one that wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. But we are not dinosaurs, and we can do something about space rocks, deflecting them before they do us any harm. September 26, NASA's DART spacecraft collided with an asteroid 7 million miles away in a proof-of-concept mission to show deflection technology works. DART stands for Double Asteroid Redirection Test, and the 1,260-pound, 8.5-foot craft was aimed at the 530-foot asteroid Dimorphos, which orbits the larger 2,560-feet asteroid Didymos. Dimorphos makes one circuit around Didymos every 11 hours and 55 minutes. The goal of DART? Smash into Dimorphos and see if it's possible to slow that orbit by 1%. Doing the same to an asteroid headed toward Earth could allow the planet time to move out of the way before a collision. DART's small size, 8.5 feet, compared with that of the 11-billion-pound asteroid it was targeting ought to have meant that it would have little effect on the rock. But when it comes to space physics, size means less than speed. And DART was tearing along at 14,000 miles per hour, so that when it hit, it packed an enormous wallop. An onboard camera sent back pictures of Dimorphos as DART approached, and at 7:14 p.m. Eastern Time, precisely the time NASA planned, the pictures and telemetry from the ship stopped, signifying the impact had taken place. Again, that asteroid weighs 11 billion pounds, or did weigh that, and it was hit by a 1,260-pound craft going 14,000 miles per hour. The question now is whether DART indeed succeeded in slowing Dimorphos. That will not be known for a few weeks, as space and Earth-based telescopes time the asteroid's path and compare their results. But NASA's optimistic. As far as we can tell, our first planetary defense test was a success, said Elena Adams, a DART program manager. I think Earthlings should sleep better. Definitely I will. That was part of the text, which was written by Jeffrey Kluger. Good question. Do curfews for teens actually reduce violent crime? This is by Josiah Bates. Philadelphia's had a curfew for kids and teenagers since the 1950s. But faced with a second straight year of record homicides and surging violent crime, the city's now doubling down on its efforts to get minors off the streets at night. A new ordinance temporarily expanded the city's 10 p.m. curfew to 16 and 17-year-olds who could previously be out till midnight. Community activists and residents tell Time that police also stepped up enforcement, picking up more kids and issuing more fines to parents. Brian Lemon, 14, from North Philly, has been detained 6 times for curfew violations this year. One night, he says, cops picked him up less than 30 seconds after the 10 p.m. curfew as he was walking home from a friend's house. They grabbed me like I killed somebody, he says, like they saw me with a gun or something. Most of the time, officers just brought him home, but twice police issued $500 fines to his mother for allowing her son to be out late. That's enough money for food in the fridge and clothes on our backs, he says. Across the country, more local leaders and police are turning to curfews for teenagers in an effort to tamp down violent crime, which has surged since 2020. In September, officials in Prince George's County, Maryland, outside Washington, D.C., began more strictly enforcing a 10 p.m. curfew for anyone under 17. On weekdays, in response to Labor Day weekend violence, in which 4 people were killed. At this point, these kids don't just need a hug, they need to be held accountable, County Executive Angela Alsobrooks declared. While it may sound like common sense to get kids home and off the streets at night, researchers say there's no evidence that curfews reduce crime. A 2015 study by professors at the University of Virginia and Purdue University looked at the impact of youth curfews on gun violence in Washington, D.C. Their analysis found the effect on public safety was ambiguous and even suggested curfews could increase the levels of violence. There are a handful of studies that have been done on juvenile curfews, and unfortunately the overall conclusion is they don't really have an impact. Dave Myers, chair of the Criminal Justice Department at the University of New Haven, says, they tend to be popular at face value. They sound good, look good, and are easy to implement. But as far as an impact on crime, it is not there. The crime numbers from before and after Philadelphia's new curfew rules bear this out. In July 2022, when the updated curfew was in effect, most violent crimes did not decrease compared with the same month a year earlier, and certain crimes, including robbery with a gun, increased drastically. Perhaps more important, community leaders worry that increasing police contact with teens from disadvantaged communities, especially black teens, could lead to more arrests and to more kids being roped into the criminal justice system. Research suggests that when black teens are in contact with police, even over minor infractions like curfew violations, it can have detrimental effects on their futures. In Philadelphia, the curfew rules have run into opposition from some community groups. It is specific communities that become over-policed without having any real impact on crime, says James Aye, who runs a youth organization called Yay Philly. The police have better things to be doing than worrying about some young people walking to and from the store. Lemon says the police curfew crackdown makes him and his friends feel targeted. I feel as though our voices are not being heard. And if it's being heard, then people just don't really care, he says. It makes black kids feel like it's not even worth talking about our experiences. From the page headed by The Brief Milestones, ended Hong Kong's required hotel COVID-19 quarantine, which was among the strictest in the world, September 26. Performing Rihanna at the Super Bowl 57 halftime show, the NFL announced September 25, granted Russian citizenship to Edward Snowden, the former National Security Agency contractor who leaked a trove of classified documents in 2013 by President Vladimir Putin, September 26. Acquitted former Texas police officer Sean Lucas of murder charges in the 2020 death of 31-year-old unarmed black man Jonathan Price by a Hunt County jury, September 22. A Texas Rangers investigation called Lucas's shooting of Price not objectively reasonable. Sued leaders of Jackson, Mississippi by city residents, September 16. Over repeated failures of the water system, which left 150,000 residents without running water in late August and early September, sabotaged the Nord Stream 1 and 2 gas pipelines, EU officials alleged September 28 after major leaks were discovered in the undersea pipelines, which run from Russia to Europe. The Kremlin's repeatedly shut off the flow of fuel amid disputes over Europe's support for Ukraine. Died Hilary Mantel, History's Voice, by Dan Stewart, who is an editor at Financial Times. It's a sad irony that in the same week Britain buried its longest-serving monarch, it also lost a novelist who dazzlingly interrogated the very meaning of monarchy. With 2009's Wolf Hall, the first in a trilogy that transformed her career, Hilary Mantel, M-A-N-T-E-L, who died September 22 at 70, immersed readers in the world of Thomas Cromwell, Henry VIII's most influential courtier. Imagining the Queen's eventual passing, Mantel said, when I interviewed her for Time in 2020, I think there will be kind of a numbness after her death. Her readers may now be feeling much the same way. That small column was abridged a bit. Slugged Yankee star Aaron Judge ties Babe Ruth by Sean Gregory. With one swing of the bat, New York Yankees outfielder Aaron Judge offered a reminder his season was chock full of magic, the kind that will be remembered for a long time. With his team trailing the Pittsburgh Pirates 8-4 in the ninth inning, September 20, Judge smashed a 95-mile-per-hour sinker deep into the left field bleachers, The ball was a no-doubter. The blast made him just the sixth player in baseball history to reach the 60 home run milestone. Joining Babe Ruth, Roger Maris, Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa, and Barry Bonds in achieving the feat. As Judge rounded the bases, the Yankee Stadium lights flashed to mark the moment. New York rallied to win. No sport reveres numbers quite like our national pastime. We love obsessing over never-before-seen accomplishments. So at first, it was somewhat easy to shrug off Judge's march toward 60 home runs. After all, players like Bonds, who hit 73 homers in 2001, and McGwire, who reached 70 3 years earlier in 1998, and Sosa, who eclipsed 60 in three different seasons, including a 66-home-run campaign in 1998, had long obliterated the prior all-time mark set by Maris, who hit 61 for the New York Yankees back in 1961. Babe Ruth slugged 60 in 1927. But let's face it, the records set by Bonds, McGwire, and Sosa are forever tainted by the fact that they occurred in the era of widespread steroid use in baseball. So any reasonable sports fan could watch Judge's power surge and know in good conscience that Judge is almost certainly the first clean baseball player in more than six decades to hit 60 homers. While there's no real way to prove that a player is 100% free of performance-enhancing drugs, plenty of athletes have escaped detection in the past, it is cynical to presume Judge is doing anything untoward. That means we are witnessing real sports history. Such moments are rare and should be cherished. There's a photo here of Yankee star Aaron Judge slamming his 60th homer. He's in the pinstripe uniform of the Yanks. There's a catcher behind him on alert. He's about to throw his bat backwards and take to the road. And there are fans on their feet in the background. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.